the adoption story for me has been such a precious journey because it really has been about me partnering with the heart of the Lord. Together, we were looking at this little tiny 7-pound baby. And he was like, we got this. Like, we got this. We're going to do this. I'm raising this baby with you. We got this. Kind of the sad part about that being so aware of my aloneness, but then so aware of the presence of God. It's actually so tender and so beautiful in the spirit when you're hearing the Lord say that. But then there is that place of, oh my God, how am I going to do this? How am I going to do this and travel and be on the road for 6 weeks at a time and live out of a suitcase? Hey, everybody, this is Rita Springer. Welcome again to the Rita Springer podcast. Worship is my weapon. This is part three of a series I started just with my adoption story, told this on the Audible podcast last year. And then when we switched to YouTube, I thought, well, why don't we just tell this on camera and pick up some more of you that maybe are in an adoption process, have thought, wondered about the adoption process or thinking about adopting. For me, it was kind of crazy. If you're coming into part three, you might want to go back and listen to part one and two. It's a pretty crazy journey. I obviously am single and doing this as a single person was an uphill climb, and yet probably the most obedient thing I've ever done with the Lord. And because it was such a God thing, I do think that because I was asked by the Lord to do it, it made the process, I wouldn't say that much easier. I think the peace in the process of it and how the Lord just kind of kept showing up and, provided the money even for the adoption and, just felt so near to him the whole time, said to me, this is the Lord, keep going through it. Cause in the other episodes, I talked about just the emphasis of, kind of being scared half out of my mind, but then thinking, okay, this is Isaac. If I just walk it up a hill, I won't have to do this and God will provide another way. And that really wasn't what God was doing. By the time I'm standing in that delivery room, which is where I think we left off in part two, and Justice is born. He's born a boy, obviously not the girl that they told me he was going to be. And so I'm kind of in this, if I was in the shock of what am I doing? I'm here with this woman. I don't know this woman. I'm going to take her child from her legally. And, I'm then going to be responsible for a small human being. I mean, just all the things that because I'm single and because I did this alone, I mean, obviously with the Lord, but I was pretty much alone. I was alone in that hospital room. I didn't have family around me. I didn't have any of my friends there. None of my siblings could come in for that. It was a very intense, alone feeling in that labor and delivery, area of that hospital. And there was kind of this, sense of, struggle in the hospital. I think with the agency and some of the nurses, there are certain nurses on staff, you know, this is 19 years ago, but that really felt like they were there to be an advocate for the birth mother. And so they would really try to convince the birth mothers to keep their children. And so the adoptive, you know, parents in waiting kind of were waiting. And then there was this kind of like back talk between the nurses and the birth mothers. And so that had been happening. And when I came on the scene, the gal that kind of ran the agency that I went through was saying, you've got to be there. You've got to be on this. You know, don't give the nurses a chance to be in. And so I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just absolutely kind of like fried emotionally because I'm in this emotional kind of thing that's about to happen that I don't even know if I'm strong enough to actually do it. And I'm almost in a sense biting off more than I feel like I can even chew at this point. And so you're not in the realm of connecting. Like I when she had justice, and all of a sudden, you know, he emerges from her womb and he has the cord wrapped around his neck. He's a little blue. And so there's a little bit of shock there. And then there's shock when the full body comes out and then the doctor announces that it's a boy. Well, I'm not prepared for a boy. Like, nobody said boy. In fact, what I was told is that thank God it's a girl, because we would never give you a boy. Boys need to be raised by dads. And so I'm trying to keep my composure. I can't really connect because the birth mother's there and I'm so responsible for her. I feel so much responsibility for her. And I remember when I came in to the hospital, you know, the Lord spoke to me out of Ruth, the book of Ruth. And he said, I want you to remember that this birth mother walks in full, but will walk out empty. And you walk in empty, but you will walk out full. So in the book of Ruth, there's this portion of the story where Naomi, who's the mother-in-law of Ruth, you know, when they leave Judea, they're leaving because of famine in the land, but she's got her husband and her two sons with her, and they go to Moab where the daughters get married, but then her husband dies and the daughters and the sons die. And then she goes back because there's food now in her homeland. And so she goes back to Judea and she comes in and she says, I left full, but I'm returning empty. So Naomi makes this statement in Ruth about the fact that she had the tangible thing that she could hold on to in the love of her husband and her children when she left, even though there was no food and there was famine and bellies were empty. But because she had the tangible, she left full. And now coming home back to a land that had food in it, but she had no husband and she had no sons. And so she was embittered and angry at the Lord because of that. And, but the wording of that, when the Lord said it, the wording of it, I understood that there's a cost in the season for how we feel full and when we experience emptiness. And when you're walking through barrenness, there's always this empty trail that's inside of you. But when I think about this birth mother of justice, is it when she walked in there, she walked in full, and but she was knowing that she was going to get emptied and leave without him in her arms. I walked in barren, and I was going to leave with something in my arms. And I felt it was really specific of the Lord to say that to me as I walked in the hospital, because he's like, I need you to remember the cost that she is enduring for you and the cost that you've borne to get here, but the cost that she has to bear in order to give you what is part of your inheritance. And I'm so grateful for that conversation with the Lord, because I realized that she, in that kind of moment of conversation with the Lord, became the heroine of our story. And that's how the Lord talked about her. That really, that's what a birth mother is. A birth mother is just, she's a heroic character in a storyline that she plays a bit part in, and then she walks away. And she gives that storyline over to somebody else to manage. And there's so much emotion there. And when I spent a lot of time thinking about and praying still for Justice's bloodline. And whenever I talk about the story of his birth, I cannot help but remember the imagery of her in the process of delivering him. And it was very surprising for her too, because, you know, she was told, just like I was told, that it was a girl. And I had this girl name something. In fact, I said to her, the language that she speaks in her kind of tribal tongue in Zimbabwe is the language of Shona. And so I said, I want you to give the baby a Shona name. And so she was like, okay, I'll pray about it and give the baby a Shona name. So I was going to call, obviously, the little girl, Liberty Selah, and then the whatever name she was going to give it in Shona. And so when this baby emerges out of her womb and it's a male baby, and I'm in shock and she's in shock, but I think she's in shock for a different reason, because the male bloodline in Africa is very different than the female bloodline. And so for her, it was the weight to give away a baby is one thing, but then the heavier weight of giving away an African male to a white woman is a little bit more costly. And I didn't even realize that until we talked about it later. But, you know, when this male boy emerges from her womb, the Lord spoke to me out of Isaiah, and he said, "Yet it's in faithfulness that I bring forth justice." And so I knew the moment that he was born, that's justice. And, you know, in the back of my mind, I thought, you know, if I did have a boy, what would I name him? And I was like, Justice, you know, or Zane Justice. I have an older brother. His name is Zane. I've always loved the name Zane. He was named after a Western author named Zane Grey. And I've always loved that name because it's a name that's, you know, it's not common. And I always love uncommon names. And my brother's just one of the kindest men I've ever met in my life. He's just got a very tender heart like my mother. And I thought, man, if I were ever to have a child, a boy that would carry the name of somebody, it would be my brother Zane, because Zane is just a kind-hearted guy, very patient, very soft-spoken, doesn't need to be the center of attention, incredibly funny and sarcastic. But I always was just like, man, that would be great if I, you know. And so I knew, you know, it'd be like Zane Justice or something like that. But when this baby's born, the Lord speaks and he says, it's justice. So I was like, that's justice, Zane. And so on the way to the hospital that morning before she had given birth to him, she told me the name that she felt like was his in Shona. And, it's a very simple name called Anesu or Anasu. And it means, God with us, almost like Emmanuel, God with us. And so, she said it's versatile. You know, it could be boy or girl. And so at that point, we're thinking it's a girl. And, Justice is born. And so his name on the birth certificate became Justice Zane Anesu Springer. And so I just want to try to paint the picture. You know, it is a glorious thing, you know, for those of you that have adopted or those of you that are in the middle of adoption, the hyperventilating state of getting to that point. And then, you know, in the state of Florida, which is where I was, and there are many states like this nowadays as well, where you have 24 hours. So basically that means that a birth mother has 24 hours after the baby's born to make a decision. And after that, her rights are cut off. And so the baby has to stay at least 20 years ago, almost 20 years ago. He had to stay in the hospital for 48 hours, but she could go home after 24. And she had 24 hours to make the decision. And so I knew I only had 24 hours. But again, if you're in this process, that 24 hours in some states, I think it's 10 days. Or 3 weeks, maybe others are 3 days. Those are the most grueling days and hours that the adoptive parent kind of walks out, because there, you can't to fully like put your heart into it. Your heart's already into it, but to put your heart fully into it, there is a massive risk that the whole thing's going to go south if the birth mother decides. And I wasn't feeling a self-centered, selfish, you know, I just want her to, I was literally feeling the weight of her decision. And I'm hung and caught in the balance of, it's going to traumatize me if she says no, but only from the perspective of I'm invested in this and I've said yes to this. And, you know, talking in the first episode about the experience with the baby, that I ended up in a fetal position over for 2 weeks, I knew that I could endure it. I knew I could get through it if that were the case. But I think for me, it was more like I wanted to be so aware of the weight of her decision. And I think that's why I can't really talk about adopting, and my adoption experience without, the weight of that, because as a woman, I cannot imagine ever having to make that decision. And so I was so aware of the decision that she was making. And there was a part of me that wanted to make it better for her. And to there was really this deep part of me that was just like, how do I help you keep him? Like, how do I help you? Like, should I just support you every month? Should I just make it easier for you? Because the weight of that as a woman, it just, and not even knowing how do you carry a baby, grow a baby inside of you? And then here is that baby that comes out and, you know, you're actually seeing what grew inside of you and you're going to have to walk away from it. And so the emotional roller coaster of her as having just giving birth and her body being in a random of emotions and her mind being in a random of emotions and me kind of on the other side. And it was just kind of this funny, awkward dance. And, you know, it's not like you're there to be chummy with the birth mom, but you're also very aware of everything you're doing. And then the agency's telling you that the nurses will try to convince her and da, 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 da. You got to stay in there the whole time. And I just, if I could have passed out, I think in the pressure and the stress of it all, I could have just lost it. And again, I was alone. And so in this kind of the sad part about that being so aware of my aloneness, but then so aware of the presence of God and the holiness of God and the holiness of really the spirit of adoption. You know, the Bible has really beautiful verses about adoption from the perspective of, you know, it talks about the spirit of adoption and the fullness of it is, you know, always attached to Israel and Gentiles and in God's father heart toward us, and that he's adopted us as sons and daughters, and we're not of the branch, but we're put into the branch, we're grafted into the branch, all this really beautiful stuff, which is if you're in the process of adoption and you don't know that, my encouragement to you is to go read and devour the scriptures that talk about adoption and understand the spirit of adoption, because what you're actually doing when you do that and you take on that baby is there is a characteristic of you that's like that God of scripture, that one true God of scripture that is saying, that's what I did for you. And so I was very aware that I was shoulder to shoulder with the Lord in something. We were partnering with something, and the spirit in which he had taken a hold of me as an orphan and fathered me, I was now partnering with him. And together we were looking at this little tiny 7-pound baby. And he was like, we got this. Like, we got this. We're going to do this. And he kept saying that to me. I'm raising this baby with you. We got this. And, you know, it's actually so tender and so beautiful in the spirit. When you're hearing the Lord say that, but then there is that place of, oh my God, how am I going to do this? How am I going to do this and travel and be on the road for 6 weeks at a time and live out of a suitcase? And so there are just all of these things that even in the memory of it, it's just so heavy. And then here's this modern day hero that is, her life's about to be shattered, and I can't help but feel all of these feelings for her. And so that 24 hours after he was born was probably some of the most grueling emotionally. So because of the nurses and the, you know, all the crazies that the hospitals do and the agencies have to fight that, it's just kind of nuts. It's like a soap opera series in adoption, in the adoption world. And, you know, the agency said to me, hey, she wants you to stay in the room with her. And I was like, what? She's like, she wants you to stay in the room with her. And I think afterward, afterward, I kind of probably assumed, I kind of was figuring out, like, I'm sure that she went to her and said, she really wants to stay here overnight. Would that be okay? And I'm sure she didn't know what to do. She was like, yeah, sure. And so then she came back to me and said, she really wants you to stay in there overnight. And that was the agency's way of protecting the alliance between the agency and the birth mother so that there was not a severing, with the hospital staff. And if I was in there all the time, then it was really a lot harder for those nurses to communicate to the birth mother by herself. And so awkwardly, I stayed on a rollout cot in the room. And it's like, I don't think the woman wanted me there. If I were that woman, I wouldn't have wanted me there. I would have wanted one night with this baby before I gave this baby up. But she was exhausted and I basically kind of took care of him all night long. And I remember in the morning, I was like, I just got to get out of here. Like, I got to get out of here. I got to get out of here. Because while I was holding Justice and all those things, all of the connecting parts to me were like, guard your heart, guard your heart, guard your heart. You better guard your heart. So I felt like there were all these like doors or like, you know, I'm closing because I didn't want to go full in until she had made the 24-hour decision. And that's just self-protection. And so in the morning, I remember I had shopped so much. And I was like, I have so many things to return. So I left around 9 o'clock, told her that I would be back in a few hours. I was just going to go shower, change back at the hotel. And then I would bring some clothing for him to wear. And so I left and I remember driving back to the hotel and just crying the whole way there and just being like, what am I doing? Like, what are we at? This is just nuts. This is crazy. This is nuts. Returned some stuff, went back to the hospital. And at that point she was changing. And I knew that the agency and the lawyer, my lawyer, were on their way. And so I had this camera and I was filming. I was trying to be the do good parent and get all the footage that I possibly can, really all the footage I could about her, because I knew it would be mean something to him one day. And I remember I had this French, I found this little French, boutique, in that area of town. And I bought this absolutely stunning little layette gown with tiny little green frogs all over it and had this matching hat with tiny little green frogs all over it. And I changed him into that. And, laid him on her bed and she had come out of the bathroom after she showered and she had this absolutely stunning. I remember she had this stunning African turban on her head in this bright color. I mean, she's stunning, stunning. My son is so handsome and it's because is the hero of our story. The birth mother is absolutely gorgeous. And so, she actually looked like a model and so she just looked this, she was so done up and beautiful. And I gave her this outfit and she changed him. She put him in this little outfit and I just took the camera and started filming it. And I remember I was looking through the camera and I realized that, you know, she was changing him. So she was over him and I was kind of filming her from the side and I just saw like, I just saw streams of water just falling and she was soaking this layette gown of his and just tears were just falling out. And the look on her face of a mother, almost like trying to memorize the etch of his face and just every part of his body, like the way her eyes were roaming around his little 7-pound body. And I just, you could just feel it in the room. You could feel that, she was looking at him probably for the last time that she'd ever see him like that. And, she hasn't seen him since. And it was just, it was heavy, heavy, heavy in that camera lens. And I almost felt like there was this holy moment of transition between her and him, where she, without words, she was just trying to tell him everything she could tell him in that moment, and almost like labor and an apology of not being able to do what I was willing to do. And so I remember I kind of shut off the camera and I just, I said something to her like, you know, it's all going to be okay. I promise you it's all going to be okay. I mean, like I felt kind of stupid even saying that. It's like for her, it wasn't going to be okay. It was going to be a really difficult journey for her. And then, you know, he went down to the nursery and the legal team came in, and within a few hours, they had signed the papers, and I was just waiting in the waiting room and waiting in the nursery with him. And the agency came in and, said everything's signed and she wants out of here. She's asking for discharge. She's getting out of here. She wants to get back to her daughter. And she had an older daughter waiting for her. And I said, okay. And I remember the Lord saying, remember, she is going to come in full, but she's going to leave empty. And so I think I said goodbye to her. And then I went back to the nursery, and she never saw him again. And she checked out of her room. They discharged her, and somebody came and picked her up, or she took a cab or something, and she left. And when the agency said, "Hey, she's just been discharged. She's left the hospital. He's yours." And that little the little tag in his incubator no longer said, you know, her last name, but it just had, you know, his name in it, his full name in it. They'd switched the cards and put the full name in it. And I had to stay there another 24 hours before I got to take him out of the hospital. And so, you know, those moments are like, I remember them so vividly and so clearly. I couldn't leave the state of Florida for, there was a 10-day grace period in there because the state of North Carolina, to where we lived in North Carolina at the time, had to match up the legal proceedings in the state of Florida. And sometimes that takes up to 10 days to do. And so not all the time. I think I was out of there maybe in seven or eight days. But I remember 48 hours later, he got discharged, and, you know, you lock him in that car seat and they wheel you to the door, or they take you to the door and they let you out the sliding glass door. And I had pulled up my car, and a nurse had brought him down. And I remember just clicking him in to the back seat and getting in the driver's seat alone in this car with this 7-pound, 12-ounce baby boy in the back. And I remember thinking, oh, and you have to understand, like I was an incredible nanny for years. So newborns are my specialty, right? Here it is. I'm in this experience on my own, and the severity of just being alone in it, and the bigness of just like, oh my gosh, what have I just done? And driving out of the hospital, you know, and around the little thing and driving down and getting on the highway and headed toward another strange hotel. And I just remember thinking, I have a human being in the back seat, and he weighs less than a sack of potatoes. And it's my responsibility to keep this kid breathing like that for the rest of my life, or until he can do it on his own. I've got to keep this kid alive. And so I remember just thinking that the whole time, the weight of that, the weight of wondering about her, the weight of, oh my gosh, you know, what am I going to do? And getting into this hotel, and then just kind of being, I had a friend actually came in, a couple friends came in for the time that I was there, so that it kind of broke the ice a little bit, which was so great to have company. But it was a wild week of being in a hotel room with this tiny little baby and starting a whole new life it was as if, you know, you have all of this stuff on a page, and then you flip the page and it's blank, and everything is a do-over. Everything is a new experience. Everything is it starts now from this point. When you, before you had the baby, that was that page. After the baby's born, it's this page, and it's full on. It is a full on morning, you know, all night. It is a full on new experience. And while it's beautiful, there are these things about it that, you know, because I had so much experience with kids, for me, I knew how to take care of a baby. That wasn't my thing. It was the weight of doing this thing with the Lord and not really knowing how it's going to go. And I do think that sometimes my melancholic sometimes state always thinks of, is something going to happen down the road? Like, what if I lose the baby to SIDS? What if some, you know, you just think those crazy things. You know, when you have a child, you climb a flight of stairs and all of a sudden in your head, you're seeing yourself falling down the stairs. I mean, just the wicked games that the enemy plays on new parents. It's like, it's insanity. And it is the responsibility of taking care of a baby is so deep, but it's also, you know, I was walking out this thing that was just kind of crazy. And everybody that was in my life kind of thought I was crazy. There were beautiful people that thought I was so valiant and so brave, but there are a lot of people that, you know, people that just wouldn't be, you know, close to me anymore because they just didn't understand single parenting and the choice of actually single parenting. And I can tell you that after bringing him back home and then realizing that in, you know, the couple weeks that I had while I was home with this brand new baby, I was going to go into surgery and they were going to try to save my uterus. So I have a brand new baby and they cut me from hip to hip a month after he's born. And now I'm recovering like a woman that had just had a C-section and all of my, so it just was this weird, crazy, crazy season where in the back of my mind, I'm like, the Lord's allowing my body to actually experience what a woman goes through when she has a C-section. What is that saying for my future? And it was just a lot. There was a lot going on, but the beauty of the nearness of God and the hope of God in that beautiful journey of adoption to me was life-changing. I say about Justice all the time that he was the best song I ever wrote because he was the best obedient yes I've ever said. And he was the most costly thing I've ever done and the most rewarding. And I wanted to do it well. I didn't want to raise a baby like that. Or any baby that I would have ever had, even if God would have given me marriage at that time and, you know, a biological child myself, I just didn't want to raise a baby in my own baggage. And so I realized there was a lot that God was kind of going to have to really scrape off the surface really in the first 3 to 4 years of his life where, you know, relationships changed and things changed and surroundings changed and all kinds of stuff changed because he was it. Like it was like, I cannot do this and still actually do this well. And so I had to shave off different things and there was, you know, day costs and morning costs and all kinds of things. And there were trips that I said yes to that were harder. There were trips that I had to say no to because I just couldn't do it. And I mean, for at least a good 4 months of having him and traveling, I would lead worship with him strapped to my chest because I just didn't want to give him to somebody unless I took somebody I knew with me that could hold him. I would just lead worship with him on my chest. And then, you know, if he got a little agitated or it was around feeding time, I would nod to somebody on the side and they would come and just pull him out of the little packet and we would move on, you know, and there were just things I had to adapt to, you know, I had to learn how to, I prayed that God would give me a sleeper because we would be in different time zones. And so I was the one exhausted more or less all the time because he was the one that just slept whenever and wherever. He was an incredible sleeper, incredible baby, incredible baby. But there was these sleep deprived moments. I remember one night I was so sleep deprived, and it was in the early stages of feeding every 3 hours, and you set your alarm. And I remember I was so exhausted in one of those early AM feedings, and I got up and I got him and I fed him, and then I put him back, and I realized that, you know, when you go to feed a newborn baby, by the time you get the newborn baby down, you're going to probably, it's going to take you another hour and a half to get to sleep. And then another hour and a half, they'll wake up for another feeding. So you're a zombie, like you're just in zombie land. And a lot of times I'd have to wake up at 5 a.m. to get a 7 o'clock flight. So it was brutal. It was brutal to do this by myself. But, and so I also, funny enough, sometimes when I hear, new moms with all the help complain, I'm all like, yeah, you don't even have any idea. I did this on my own. So sometimes my grace button is a little bit like, yeah, well, try doing it on your own. But I remember one night I was so exhausted that I just threw myself on the floor of my bedroom, and I just started just sobbing and wailing. Like, I can't do this. I can't do this anymore. I am so tired. I said, I'm so tired. And I heard the Holy Spirit say to me almost audibly that night, he just said, I, the Lord your God, neither slumber nor do I sleep. And he said, I will give you what you need. And I just had this epiphany laying on the floor sobbing that God had been awake my whole life. Like, God never sleeps. He's awake all the time. And so I remember I leaned up and I just was like, can you give me what you have in order to do what I need to do? Just give me that kind of strength. And I felt it. I felt like the Lord just, he just came down, and the 2 hours of sleep that I had that was sound that night seemed to be like 8 the next day. And that's the way that the Lord worked. Everything that I needed, especially in those early months, he provided. And he was just there. I look back on that time, and as much as some of it was just so emotional and lonely, God was always there, and he was always right in the middle of it. And he was always willing to just hang out with Justice. I mean, I could feel the presence of the Lord in his room. And, you know, I had my friend come, and she had painted that crib with all the names of God the way I had dreamed that years before ever adopting him. And so here was this little baby that was lying in that crib that I had dreamed of maybe 5 years prior. And here I knew that the resemblance and the meaning of God and who he was just, you know, all around Justice. And funny enough, when Justice began to speak, he would talk about, this best friend that he had, and he would call this best friend Jawa, and he would say the craziest things about this best friend of his. And it wasn't until one day he came in from the porch, he was about 3 years old, and he said that Jawa had just, his best friend Jawa had just told him how he had fastened and knitted the wings on bees. And I realized that he was talking to the Lord, and Justice had this elaborate imagination, and he had this, you know, Jawa was a pilot, and they flew all the time. And every time we got on a plane, Jawa would show up and say, I'm flying this plane. I was just crazy, 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 crazy stories, because I felt like the Lord's promise of always being with him and fathering him was so kind on the early days. And Justice doesn't remember any of those stories now, but even throughout his life, God has stepped in and fathered the kid. And, you know, I have to say that many parents maybe don't invite the Lord into those areas. I don't know how you parent without Jesus. I do not know how you parent without Jesus. And I just asked the Lord to do that. And so when Justice got sick, I had a father that knew how this was going to go down. I had a father that could tell me he doesn't need antibiotics. This one will be, it'll blow over in a couple of days. And I was listening to that voice, and I was walking with that voice. And, you know, I could feel the Lord being like, he's got issues with his ears. So it's like, okay, take him in. He ended up getting tubes in his ears because he had ear infections all the time. And He had a high pain tolerance. I mean, just, I don't know what I would have done without the Lord. I mean, I remember when Justice was in the fifth grade and I put him to bed. He went to bed around 7:30, 8 o'clock at night, you know, and, or 8:30. And I was just kind of, I don't know, maybe 10:30 at night. And I was just getting ready to go to bed myself. And the Lord said to me, "Hey, he's wrestling with something he needs to talk to you about." And I was like, "Oh gosh, you know, is this the sex talk? Like, oh my God, am I going to be in for it tomorrow if I ask him?" And so I just was like, "Okay, I'll ask him." And that next night I was putting him to bed. I was like, "Is there something that's going on with you, a question you want to ask me?" And cause the Lord had said he has a question he needs to ask you. And he was like, "No." And I was like, "Are you sure? Like, there's nothing pressing in on your heart." And he said, "Well, yes, there is. And, is it okay for me to ask you?" And I'm like, "Here it is. Like, come on, let's just do it right now." And he said to me, as a fifth grade kid, "Can you tell me what the N word means?" And I just was stunned. And here's this sweet little black boy in the fifth grade that God's telling me the night before that, you know, he's got this circling question that he doesn't know how to ask and respond to. And, but the Lord knew it. And it was the most beautiful conversation we'd had at that point. And it was so precious to be able to be like, "Okay, let me take you to the beginning stages of that word." And then the way they use it now. And then I just was like, "Where are you hearing that word? Are you being called that word at school? Like, what's happening?" And he's like, "No, we're reading Huckleberry Finn." And he's like, I think it's in Huckleberry Finn over a couple hundred times. And while I know that that's a classic novel, it really was one of those moments where it provoked me to, you know, just have a conversation with his school that he was going to and saying, you've got African, black children in this school. You don't have a high percentage of them, but you have them, and you guys need to be more aware when you're reading these kind of books that this has to be discussed, in the classroom as a whole before you just let a kid, you know, have to come home with this because they're engaged in these things. But all that to say, it's because the Lord was just meeting me, and the Lord knew what was going on with him. All through high school, the Lord knew what was going on with him. And I had to engage the Lord in deeper and deeper and deeper, deeper levels. I probably could do a whole podcast just on single mothering, which I probably will just encourage those of you that are doing it on your own. But you know, the adoption story for me has been such a precious journey because it really has been about me partnering with the heart of the Lord. And, I'm trying to recollect if I said this in the other podcast, but I'll say it again here just as a, to reiterate this. But in our court system here in the States, it's all over the world as well, but you can separate your right legally from your biological child. You can go into a court system and you could have it revoked. You could have the biological, rights revoked. But when you adopt a child, it is against our law for you to revoke your right to be the child's parent. So when I, 4 months after he was born, went in to solidify and finalize the adoption, I had to raise my right hand in front of a judge. And the judge says, "You realize by the law of adoption, you cannot sever your right to be his parent." Now, if I was a crap parent, the government could take him away from me. Absolutely. But I couldn't just say, I don't want him anymore without paying, a severe cost in, the court system for it because it's against the law. And so I say that because, you know, as we come like to close this third part of this beautiful story of mine, where I got the greatest thing in the world ever given to me, I partnered with the Lord in adoption. And that's what adoption really is. Adoption is you partnering with God and taking on, I think it's a biblical thing for us all to want to house and love the orphan. It's biblical. Everybody should do it. I think that the problem with our orphan epidemic today and our foster care system today is because the church isn't doing its job taking care of the orphan. That's a whole other podcast. Maybe we'll get to that. But if the church began to get a heart for the orphan, there would be no more orphans. And because it's a biblical attribute of God to adopt us as sons and daughters. And what it means is that he cannot sever his right to be our father. And that should blow your mind. Like that should explode your head in God's precious, kind, enduring love for us, that he is a kind, good, loving father. And I just encourage all of you out there that are in the adoption process, as hard as it is sometimes, the waiting game and all of those things, that you stay in it, because what you're doing and what you're going after is the very heart of the Lord. I do think you need to not fill a void of not having a child, but you need to come into alignment with the covenant of adoption so that it's a full thing that you're doing and not just you trying to fill a void that you need filled because you want to be a mother or you want to be a parent. Don't do it for that reason. Do it because you want to be a parent, but you also want to align yourself with the mercy and the heart and the beauty of God for the orphan, and that you want to be the representation of Christ as home to the orphan. And so I'm so glad I did it. Hardest thing I've ever done in my life. Most rewarding thing I've ever done in my life. And it still blows my mind every day that Justice's story is ongoing. And I can't wait for him one day to connect to his bloodline and understand the other side of who he is as well. So bless all of you in your pursuit and your journey. And I hope this encouraged you in that.